I have to keep it quiet because I'm sneaking around here. I've gotten close to the biggest psychiatric hospital in Indiana, and I'm sneaking around trying to see what's going on in here and how crazy these people are. And there's a big hall right down here around the corner. I'm going to open up the door and see what's going on. And there's some guy up on the stage giving a speech about Satan or Lucifer or something. Said he had pipe organs built into his body. Let's listen to what he's got to say.
Violins are stringed instruments. Satan had been given a very special, very distinctive commission from God to minister unto him and cover his glory with music through worship and praise. He was a walking orchestra. Whenever Satan came into the presence of God, he not only could sing the music, he played, he accompanied himself from his own body. And that was the distinctive creative purpose that God gave to him. He was one of God's best works of creation for the purpose of praising God in heaven. And then in verse 15, we're told that his perfection was actual. He was perfect in his ways from the days he was created.
Say what?
But don't let anybody tell you that Satan was created by God. God created Lucifer, and Lucifer became Satan of his own will.
Oh.
Otherwise, you implicate God in the creation of evil, and you know that's not possible. Notice his place. Where did he live? I can't take you to all these scriptures and go into detail, but if you'll just underline them in your Bibles, you will find out quickly where he lived. Verse 13, Eden, the garden of God. Verse 14, the holy mountain of God. Verse 14, he walked back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones. Verse 18, he defiled your sanctuaries. He lived in the sanctuary. Lucifer, before his fall, had access to the throne of God. He lived in the second heaven, which is interstellar space, but he was able to go into the third heaven where God dwelt. And he came often before the throne of God to worship him and to praise him. He lived in heaven. And then notice his power. Verse 14, you are the anointed cherub who covers. Here you can see Lucifer's exalted position at the time of creation. He was one of the cherubs that could look upon the face of God and praise and give thanksgiving to him. The cherubim were of the highest orders of angels, as we've learned in our series.
I got to get out of here. I got to get out of here. This must be the wackiest wackos in the world. And I'll tell you, on the car radio driving over here, that's all I heard on the radio is whacked out stuff, man. But you know, there's still people trying to sell this to good white people, good white separatists who still believe in this stuff. I want to tell you something. These people are insane. There's no other word you can put on it. They're insane. And they're like addicts, drug addicts. Now, when you try to take that away from them, they're drug, they're going to try to kill you. And when you try to straighten out this white country, supposedly white here in North America, what do you think those people are going to do that believe all that stuff? These insane people that are in that institution. In fact, the whole state of Indiana is an institution like that, and most other states too. So anyhow, I just thought I'd... That was what I did on my Sunday off, so I figured you'd be interested.
Max, a present. America has no now. We're reluctant to acknowledge the present. I guess it's too embarrassing. You know what America lacks? A present. America has no now. We're reluctant to acknowledge the present. I guess it's too embarrassing. Instead, we reach into the past. Our culture is composed of sequels, reruns, remakes, revivals, reissues, re-releases, recreations, reenactments. Adaptations, anniversaries, memorabilia, oldies radio, and nostalgia record collections. World War II has been refought on television so many times, the Germans and Japanese are now drawing residuals. Of course, being essentially full of shit, we sometimes feel the need to dress up. up this past preoccupation, as with pathetic references to reruns as encore presentations. Even instant replay is a form of token nostalgia, a brief visit to the immediate past for re-examination, before slapping it onto a highlight video for further review and re-review on into the indefinite future. This yestermania of ours includes fantasy baseball camps, where aging sad sacks pay money to catch baseballs thrown by men who were once their heroes. It's part of the fascination with sports memorabilia, a memory industry, and it's so lucrative it has attracted counterfeiters. In this case, the age of hyphens, we are truly retro Americans. And our television newscasts not only reflect this condition, they feed it. Everything they report is twisted into some reference to the past. If there's going to be a summit meeting, you'll be told all about the last six summit meetings. If there's a big earthquake, they'll do a story about big earthquakes of the past. If there's a mine disaster, you'll hear about every mine disaster since the inception of mining. They're obsessed with looking back. I swear, I actually heard this next thing during a newscast as the anchorman went to a commercial break. He said, "Still ahead, a look back." Honest, he said it.
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy getting off to a little jerky start, but here we are, right here in the bunker, right here in the Bob Matthews Memorial Bunker, right here in North Central Indiana. Our P.O. Box is 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Our big website is resist.com. My email address is TM, that's Thomas Mary _ Metzger, M-E-T-Z-G-E-R, @yahoo.com. And to check in with our webmaster for any reason, that is merchandise, resist, @yahoo.com. That's right. And our big national phone number is 559-670-1473. And, of course, if you want to try to call me here in the bunker when I'm around or when I'm not real busy, you can call 574-267-5036. And if I'm not around, just leave a message. You know the old saying, you can't serve two masters? You can't have two bosses, you can't have two leaders, or whatever. I hear these various racially or anti-Jew radio shows once in a while. I get a little time, I tune them in. I notice that Christians are always holding on there trying to make excuses for Christianity. And usually the moderator, and I've done it too for years, try to make some kind of peace with Christianity, you know. It took me years to get out of it. And that's one of the reasons I'm so strident about my opposition to Christianity, because it's like being stuck in quicksand. It is extremely hard to get out. It's just, it's like trying to stop smoking cigarettes, and you know how addictive nicotine is. Now, if I had to listen to radio around here, AM or FM, it's they got Christ Insanity programs going 24/7 all week. And if you don't, if you're not getting that, you're getting Nigger Ball. And maybe a little rock and roll, maybe a little country music, but primarily it's preachers. And then any political stuff that's on there is so ridiculous and so primitive that it's no wonder the people don't know what the hell they're doing. Anyhow, I hear these people trying to weasel into these radio shows and try to bring Christianity back into it. You're not going to do it. And if you do it, you'll destroy whatever they're trying to do, because Christianity is not our our religion. And I hate the word religion. Christianity was forced upon us in Europe and the Nordic countries, Eastern Europe and so forth. I believe the last great battle for our race, and I'm not going to say our religion because it's just our race, period, was in Lithuania against the Jew church. And ever since then, they've been, Jewish Christianity has been screwing us up. And then the virus was brought over here from Europe, and it was taken all over the world. Now, I know that by saying to the public or anybody else that I'm racist and I'm an atheist, that's going to lose me a lot of support. But you have to wonder what that support was built on in the first place. I know in Christianity, if you leave one church and go to another, you become an outcast. I know that when I was in Christian Identity, I was a wonderful guy. When I left, a large percentage of the Christian Identity preachers and others started stabbing me in the back, or at least bad-mouthing me all the time. So even if you're a Christian, if you're not the right kind of Christian, you're in big trouble. In Europe, the Catholic Church spent a hell of a lot of time exterminating people they disagreed with and also robbing the common people blind. So when these people that broken away from the Catholic Church got over here to the colonies and got over here to North America, they didn't want any part of the Catholic Church. And so they started persecuting Catholics that came over here. So it's been back and forth, this persecution within the Christian Church. I know one thing, since leaving Christianity in 1980, I've had far less trouble, far less problems than I had when I was within Christianity. Because you had to argue both ways. You had to argue your racial position, and you had to argue a religious position. I don't have to do that anymore. I don't spend any time debating those people because most of them are insane. Some of them are more insane than others. A lot of Christians are more enlightened, and they would say, oh, these guys that are preaching that stuff like you were playing on here, yeah, they are crazy, but we're not crazy. It's just them. And don't forget, you can't buy into equality of any kind. The only equality, I guess you would call, and even that is not exactly equal, and that's death. You go to a cemetery, you see some great big tall monuments, 8-10 foot tall. You see actual stone houses, some of them big enough that a person could live in. And other places where there are people in the ground with no marker at all, like many of our people. But once you buy into that, anything that goes along with it, which is funny because the Christian Church pushes it now, but the Christian Church never was that way. There was no equality. The sheep, maybe, that gave them the money and their cows and their pigs and everything, their gold. But the priest had all the money. The preachers got the checkbook in all these churches, so there's not much equality going on there. When I was a kid, this one church my parents and I went to, the preacher, every once in a while, he'd hit the congregation up. He wanted more money, or he was going to go to some other city or town, church, preach there because they're going to give him more money. So then they gave him more money, and then he wanted a bigger house. They called it the parsonage. They built him a house as big as the church. to live in luxury. So Christians don't even believe their own mythical crap. They're not giving away their clothing and their cars and so forth and their houses to give to the poor or anything like that. No, that's crap. Now the corporations have got into the act. Here in Indiana, they have this Riley Hospital down in Indianapolis for kids with problems. And so they want to raise money for the hospital. Well, that's not a bad idea if you truly want to give the money. But now the corporations have all these stores around town, and when you purchase the merchandise, they say, would you like to give your change to the Riley Hospital? I say no, and they look at me sort of funny. When I donate straight to somebody like on the street or something, a veteran standing on a corner. Or maybe I won't give any money at all. But anyhow, the point is, I say to these people, I say, wait a minute, how much money has the corporation that owns the store donated to the Riley Hospital? Well, I don't know. Well, they're making you a slave to beg for money and try to use guilt to get us to give you our money. I tell every clerk that does that. And sometimes I think the lights come on, but most of the time the lights stay off. But the amazing thing is everybody knows there's no equality. In down deep, subconsciously at least, they know, they look around you, equality to my ass. Yeah, they know it, but they still want to kid themselves. They still cling on to the old, I got my rights, the Bill of Rights. Constitution is worthless. Even the things that are written on a Constitution are only enforced as long as you're willing to bleed and use ruthless physical reaction to keep it that way. Now, you pay taxes to have hired guns to protect your property and your house, the cops. But if for every cop, there's hundreds of citizens. Now, you know as well as I do, one cop cannot logically handle major problems if, say, half of those 100 people went bonkers. So essentially, you're on your own. And you always have been on your own. And you're kidding yourself if you depend on the cops or anybody else to be a perfect answer to your problem. I mean, if the hired guns, if you didn't pay your taxes, or if the cops went on strike, and 50 niggers came down the street who wanted what you've got, and you could scream, I got my rights, you can't do that all you want. You'd be dead laying on the ground and everything would be gone. That's just the way it is. Might is right is pretty much right. Might makes right. And that's exactly the system we live under. Only it's their might and their right. The ruling class. It's always been that way. So that's where Christianity comes in. They use Christianity as their tool to weaken you, to make you feel guilty. The only real free person is outside the law. The only real free person. Now, of course, you don't want to go to prison, you don't want to go to jail, so you try to skirt the problem. But in reality, that's it. The only truly free person is outside the law, because the law makes you a slave. Now, a true white man or white woman going to be outside the law of their life? Oh, well, they're going to try not to get themselves into a situation. But you're going to think outside the law, because the law is slavery. Now, here's something I picked up. And let's see here. Here we go. Well, I looked over here and I saw my audio going down. And I forgot I had batteries in a preamp. And so I checked them and they were down. So I had to take a little time here and splice in a power supply instead of using those batteries. So I'm back with you now. I hope the volume's loud enough in the beginning of the show that you can understand it. You know, I found this book on entitled Antebellum. Yeah. And I really like this book because it pretty much lays out that this man by the name of Hinton Rowan Helper, way back before the Civil War, was trying to set up a plan to get rid of the blacks. And he was a white racist, but not a white racist capitalist. He was a white racist people person. Anyhow, in this book, and you should try to get a copy, there's one sentence that stuck out at me. Listen to this. Good men obey superior authority, the laws of God, of morality, and of their country. Bad men love liberty and violate them. Ha ha ha! That pretty much wraps it up right there. If you're a liberty-loving white man, you're a bad man. I guess that's why they called the outlaws of the Old West bad men. And they went out to the Badlands. You know, the Badlands were the area where they could get away from the Jew law and the Jew church and all that stuff. And all the laws that come down on you. In fact, that's why millions of settlers moved west. Not only to get land, but to get away from the crap. Now, some people get nostalgic, and they'll give you this crap about, well, back in the day, people weren't like that, and people were their honor, or their word was their honor, and they didn't lie, and they didn't cheat, and they didn't squeal, and believe me, that's all bullshit. The masses have always done that. Only a very small 1% or less have been worth a damn over time for thousands of years. As far as what we're concerned. So, back in your daddy's day, and my daddy's day, people were snitching on each other and lying to each other and squealing to the cops and squealing to the government, squealing to the army. So don't let them tell you it was any different before. It's just now we got more modern conveniences. We got so-called conveniences. You got a cell phone you're probably on all the time. And if you don't use a cell phone strictly for business, you should stay off a cell phone. Personal information, all that kind of stuff, you should never even be on the cell phone. I got 100 minutes a month, and I never even use 100 minutes because I get very few calls, and I don't ask for very many calls. It's mostly for an emergency. If my lady needs to contact me, or I need to contact her, or one of my kids need to contact me, there you go. But if you're hanging on those damn cell phones, you're asking for trouble. And everybody slips once in a while and may say something that may either get you in a jam or get some other lone wolf friend in a jam. So try to stay off those cell phones. Plus, I think they've pretty well proven now that people are getting brain cancer from that stuff. And women have even been getting breast cancer from sticking a phone down in their bra. I used to say, well, maybe that's just sort of an old wives' tale. But no, the research is in as far as I'm concerned. So you got to keep that cell phone out of your ear. Now, when cars go by my house, almost everybody's got a cell phone in their ear. If you're pulling out of a parking lot at a grocery store, almost everybody you see pulling in and out is on a phone. Who in the hell are they talking to? What the hell are they talking about? They don't need NSA. People give them all the information free. You tell them all about yourself. You talk about, I like my freedom, which you're not free. You're just in a big S, a giant concentration camp, a giant Sing Sing, in which you have the illusion of freedom. And the people who don't go along with the system are usually scared into going along with the system. They're scared of the system. You know as well as I do, when you're driving down the highway and you get a highway patrolman on your back bumper, don't you feel anything in your gut? I don't care whether you belong to anything or you're into politics or a Klansman or what. Don't you get that feeling? I think you're lying if you say you don't. So they keep you in fear all the time. Fear, fear. Now they got the fear over in Ukraine. You got to be afraid. You got to be afraid. And all the people in the government and the media here yapping about the Ukraine, thousands of miles away. You're supposed to be afraid. They got a big airliner missing. You got to be afraid. What does that mean? They're going to come and dive bomb into your house? Your whole life is run by fear. When you get, and Christianity is a great fear monger, I'm telling you. You're going to go to hell and burn in the lake of fire forever. I wish I had a quarter for every person that's called on my telephone over the years and told me, God's going to get you, and you're going to burn in the lake of fire forever. Bless you, my brother. Bye-bye. I watched an interesting film last night. It was produced in New Zealand. And it was around the time of the Boer War, and Englishmen that were so stupid to go fight the Boers were losing their young men and so forth. And one man asked the other, see, how was it, he said, how are we doing in that Boer War? Are we winning? And the guy turned to him and says, we're losing slower. That was his description of winning, was losing slower. In other words, we're losing less men than they are. I thought that was a terrific comeback. Because white men never win in these wars. Never. None of them. I mean, and the troops don't even get the goody booty like it used to in the old days. You go sack a city or a country, the soldiers got paid off by just grabbing the goodies. And even carrying off the women. What do you guys get? What do these guys get in this country? They get shit and shoved in it. Now they're getting infected with this deleted uranium. And nobody gives a shit. They don't even seem to give a shit. Well, maybe that's okay, because there's no cure for it, boys. Once that radiation gets into your body, into your brain, that's it. Here's a little bit I recorded late last night interviewing a Korean woman, talking about the discrimination by Japanese against Koreans. And I knew it's there because they told me all about it when I was in Japan. But that's the way it is. Tribalism. Racism, tribalism, and so forth. People who have a desire to be separate and have their own cultures and so forth. Listen to this.
they weren't actually talking about the articles or what they were not happy about, but immediately they started saying, oh, look at her, she's got such tiny eyes, she must be Korean Japanese.
Well, I think you have very nice eyes, Monica, but it sounds like you were a victim of what in Japan they call the netuyo, net for internet, and the rest of it means sort of hyper-nationalists. And these are a kind of a big presence in Japanese internet, is that right?
Indeed, their voices are very loud, and you do see their comments a lot. Indeed, not just online, but some of the nationalists have taken to the streets, having huge protests against foreigners, especially Korean Japanese, like this one last year.
Our story, Mariko, is not about these guys. It's actually about their rivals, the anti-racist movement, who started trending very recently. So let's take people now to Shin-Okubo. This is a neighborhood of Tokyo, which some call Koreatown. So Japan has not had huge immigration, but there are an estimated 500,000 ethnic Koreans in Japan, and the newcomers come to this part of Tokyo, where there are now 53 pieces of documented anti-Korean graffiti as well, as Miwa Nakamura explains.
It's not like spray painted or anything. It's just like, I think it's like a magic marker type of scrawling. And most of it was aimed at Korean people, saying Koreans go home and or go back to where you came from, or, you know, Koreans are trash, or they're cockroaches.
So that's Miwa Nakamura, an anti-racism campaigner who I've been speaking to this week. So her story is that she was upset by the rise of the netuyo. Last year, she got so outraged by them that she joined a march on the streets against them. Then the police actually banned nationalist marches and anti-racism marches, and that's when graffiti started appearing on the streets. So then she answered another call on Twitter to start documenting racist graffiti. People came from around Tokyo, Japanese people like Miwa, and they started taking photographs of the graffiti scribbles and putting their locations onto a Google map.
I'm just angry that this hurting others just so that they can feel better about themselves.
What were you trying to achieve by using the internet this way?
We wanted to show how prevalent it was. We wanted to show that, especially those people who only hear about this on the internet, we wanted to see that it has now seeped into real life.
So Mariko, Miwa got slammed by the netuyo online, a bit like yourself. Her address was even briefly posted online by them. But did that galvanize Japan's attention then, do you think?
Well, it certainly attracted a lot of clicks online, and I think those protests from last year, I think people didn't actually realize how massive this kind of racism was until then. I remember talking to a reporter friend who said he felt reluctant to cover these events because it would actually give them exposure, but then it actually really surprised people that there have been kind of counter protests and, you know, someone like Miwa, and now people are taking pictures, organizing parties to raise those graffiti.
Anyhow, the Japanese are very culturally independent. And isn't it interesting how always when you simply want people to respect your territory, your tribal territory, your individual territory, you're bad. You're supposed to feel bad. It's amazing. You know, they swarm onto your shores, into your country, into your neighborhoods, and if you resist, well, you're so hateful, you're terrible, you should accept us, and no problem, right? It sort of reminds me of a book. There's a man I used to read a lot named Albert J. Nock, who wrote back in the 30s. And he was pretty much a libertarian type, and I still enjoy his writings. And it's sort of like if your neighbor's cow breaks down the fence and comes into your garden, and the cow's there eating your garden that you're getting your food from, and you go out there and yell at the cow, and the cow don't go anyplace and don't go back over in the neighbor's pasture, you hit him on the ass with a tuba fore, and then you're... And then the cow would go over back home, and then the neighbor would file a complaint with the SPLC. I get SPLC, had the animal rights people mixed up. But anyhow, he'd be suing you for hurting his animal or for scaring his animal. You see the logic there? His animal commits the crime because he let his animal get under your garden. But when you resist and try to chase the cow back into his pasture, then you're the criminal. See, this is Soviet Principle 10. This logic has been around for a long time, but the Soviets really put it into a printed form. And I've told you this before. When the communists were on the run, moving into countries, their logic was, we're bringing you great communism. We're bringing you everything. We're bringing you a wonderful system. Now, if you resist us bringing you the system that we have that's so wonderful, then you're the aggressor, and you must be prosecuted or killed. See, that's the logic. That's the logic. The whole world's running by this logic. But under predatory capitalism and political parties and so forth, and the U.S. government, it's gotten really bad. So you can't even discriminate. You can't be a free man and not discriminate. Only free men have the natural ability to discriminate. Slave can't discriminate. So when somebody tells you they hate discrimination, say, well, you hate freedom, you hate liberty then. What do you mean? I love liberty. I love freedom. No, you don't. Because you have taken away people's right to discriminate. I mean, it's as simple as that. So let's go over it again. You don't have equality. That's bullshit. You don't have rights. You only have privileges. That's bullshit. I mean, that's the truth, but that's the way it is. You can't discriminate, so you can't be a free man. You can't have liberty. And if you resist all this nonsense, you're the bad guy. You're the outlaw. So that's why I say we should always support the people in prison, because even if we don't like it, they're outlaws. We're probably better off with the outlaws on the outside than the in-laws or the people that are out here now. I think a lot of the people around here, and probably this community I live in, are probably more dangerous to me than most of the guys in prison who were dealing pot or cocaine or heroin or whatever. I don't care if they deal in pot or cocaine or heroin. I mean, you know, I don't think it's a good thing for your health, but I'm not going to use it, and none of my kids used it, so that's the way it goes. You got to handle that on a personal basis. Now I'm going to go to a novel that I've had in my possession for a long time. Most people don't know about it. It wasn't highly publicized. It was written by George Steiner, called Portage to San Cristobal of Adolf Hitler. And the gist of the story is they've been hunting all over for Hitler. They finally find him down in a village in the Amazon, and this team of Jews go over to get him, find him. And they did, but he's weak and frail and not healthy, and they have to carry him out of the jungle to get him to a plane or a helicopter to get him out. But in the process, there's some conversations that happen. Now, this is chapter 17. I'm going to read it direct. You might not quite understand a couple of things here, but I think you'll understand a lot of it. Here we go. Article 1. Because you must understand that I did not invent. It was Adolf Hitler who dreamt up the master race. This is a Jew talking. Who conceived of enslaving inferior peoples. Lies, lies. It was in the Das House, in the Mannerheim, that I first understood it was in. God help me, but that was long ago. And the lice, large as a thumbnail, 1910, 1911. What does it matter now? It was there that I first understood your secret power. The secret power of your teaching, of yours, a chosen people chosen by God for his own. The only race on earth chosen, exalted, made singular among mankind. It was Grill who taught me. Do you know about Grill? No. You know nothing about me, Jan Grill, but that wasn't his name. Do you hear me? Called himself Jan, said he was a defrocked priest. For all I know, he may have been. That too, but his real name was Jacob, Jacob Grill, son of a rabbi from Poland, or Galicia, or what does it matter? One of yours, we lived close. One soap sliver between us. It was the Grill who taught me, who showed me the words, the chosen people, God's own, unclean, among the unclean, amid the welter of nations, who shall be chastised for impurity, for taking a heathen to wife, who shall have bondsmen and bondswomen from among the goyim, but stay apart. My promise was only 1,000 years, to eternity, said Grill. Lo, it is written here, in the letters of white fire, the covenant of the election, the setting apart of the race, das heilige Volk, like unto no other, under the iron law. Circumcision and the sign on your forehead, one law, one race, one destiny, unto the end of time. And Joshua burnt Ai and made it a heap forever, even desolate unto this day. And Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation. All of them, men, women, children, to serve Israel in bondage. But more often there was no one to enslave, and they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, ox and sheep and ass. With the edge of the sword, your holy books. The smell of blood, Jacob Grill, friend Grill, and Newman, for whom I painted postcards. They smelt of shit, but they taught me that a people must be chosen to fulfill its destiny, that there can be no other thus made glorious, that a true nation is a mystery, a single body willed by God, by history, by unmingling burning of its blood. It does not matter what you call the roots of the dream, the mystery of the will of chosenness to conquer its promised land, to cut down or lay bondage all who stand in its path, to proclaim itself eternal. Let the trumpet blow in Zion, let the cherubim of the Lord bring fire and plague upon our enemies. You could hear the lice crack between Grill's fingers. God, how his breath stank. But he read from the book, your book, of which every letter is sacred, every mite of every letter. That's so, isn't it? Read till lights out, and after sing song through the nose, because he knew it by heart. From his school days he had heard his father, the rabbi. They utterly destroyed all that was in the city in Samaria, because the Samaritans read a different scripture, because they built a sanctuary of their own, of terebinth, 6 cubits to the left. They had made it 7 or 5, or God knows. Put to the sword the first time, every man, woman, and child. Sheox, the dogs too. No, no dogs. They are the unclean things that hop or crawl on the earth, like the Philistine, the unclean of Moab, the lepers of Sidon. To slaughter a city because of an idea, because a vexation over words, Well, that was a high invention, a device to alter the human soul. You Jews' invention. One Israel, one folk, one leader. Moses, Joshua, the anointed king who has slain his thousands, no, his 10,000s, and danced before the ark. It was in Compiègne, wasn't it? They say I danced there, only a small dance. The pride of it, the brute cunning, whatever you are, wherever, be it ulcerous as a Job, as Job, or Newman scratching his stinking crotch. You should have seen the two of us peddling those postcards like starved dogs. But what does it matter if you're one of the chosen people, one of God's familiars, above all other men, set apart for his ages and his love, in a covenant, a singling out, a consecration, never to be lost. Grill told me that. John Jacob Grishmuel Grill, or whatever his greasy name was, reeking of piss when he crawled up the stairs, even he, the apostate, the outcast of Zion, was still of the chosen, a private vexation to the Almighty. Listen, he said, listen, Adi, no man else ever called me that. You think you see me as I am? Grill, the loser, the Doss House bum. But you're blind. All you Goyim are blind. For all you know, Adi, I am one of the 72. Chosen. Chosen even above the chosen. One of the secret just ones on whom the earth rests. And while you snore tonight and wallow in your spit, listen to me, Adi. Here in this barrack, right here, my blind friend, the Messiah, may come to me and know me for his own. And he would roll his eyes and give a little laugh, a yellow Jew laugh. It went through me like a knife, but I learned from you everything to set a race apart, to keep it from defilement, to hold before it in a promised land, to scour that land of its inhabitants or place them in servitude. Your beliefs, your arrogance in Nuremberg, the searchlights, the clever beaver, spear, straight into the night. Do you remember them? The pillar of fire that shall lead you to Canaan, and woe unto the Amorites and the Jebusites and the Kenites and the half-men outside God's pact. My Superman. Second-hand stuff. Rosenberg's philosophic garbage. They whispered to me that he too, the name, my racism was a parody of yours, a hungry imitation. What is a thousand-year right compared to the eternity of Zion? Perhaps I was the false Messiah sent before. Judge me, and you must judge yourselves. Ubermenschen, chosen ones. What my client means, began Asher. There had to be a solution, a final solution, for what is a Jew if he is not a long cancer of unrest? Gentlemen, I beg your attention. I demand it. Was there ever a crueler invention, a contrivance more calculated to harrow human existence than that of the omnipotent, all-seeing, yet invisible, impalpable, inconceivable God? Gentlemen, I pray you, consider the case, consider it closely. The pagan earth was crowded with small deities, malicious and consoling, winged and pot-bellied, in leaf branch and rock and river, giving companionship to man, pinching his bottom or caressing him, but of his measure, delighting in honey cakes and roast meat, gods after their own image and necessities. And even the great deities, the Olympians, would come down in mortal visitation to do war and lechery. Mightier than we, I grant you, but tangible, and taking on the skin of things. The Jew emptied the world by setting his God apart, immeasurably apart from man's senses. No image, no concrete embodiment, no imaging even. A blank empty, emptier than the desert, yet with a terrible nearness, spying on our every misdeed, searching out the heart of our heart for motive. A God of vengeance into the 13th generation. Those are the Jews' words, not mine. A God of contracts and petty bargains, of indentures and bribes. And the Lord gave Job twice as much as he'd had before, 1,000 she-asses where they grazed. Boiled old man had had only 500 to start with. It makes one vomit, doesn't it? Twice as much. Gentlemen, do you grasp the slimliness of it, the moral trickery? Cast your guiltless servant into hell, thunder at him over the whirlwind, draw Leviathan by the nose, and then double his income, declare a dividend, slip him a lordly tip. Why did Job not spit at the cattle dealer of a god? Yet the Holy of Holies was an empty room, a silence in a silence. And the Jew mocks those who have pictures of their God. His God is purer than any other, and very thought of him exceeds the powers of the human mind. We are as blown dust in his immensity, but because we are his creatures, we must be better than ourselves. Love our neighbor. Be continent. Give of what we have to the beggar, because his inconceivable, unimaginable presence envelops us. We must obey every jot of the law. We must bottle up our rages and desires, chastise the flesh, and walk bent in the rain. You call me a tyrant, an enslaver? What tyranny, what enslavement has been more oppressive, has branded the skin and the soul of man more deeply than the sick fantasies of the Jew? You are not God-killers, but God-makers, and that is infinitely worse. The Jew invented conscience, left man a guilty serf. But that was only the first piece of blackmail. There was the worst to come. The white-faced Nazarene. Gentlemen, I find it difficult to contain myself, but the facts must speak for themselves. What did that epileptic rabbi ask of man? That he renounce the world? That he leave his mother and father behind? That he offer the other cheek when slapped? That he rendered good for evil? That he loved his neighbor as himself? No, far better, for self-love is an evil thing to be overcome. Oh, grand castration! Note the cunning of it. Demand of human beings more than they can give. Demand that they give up their stained, selfish humanity in the name of a higher ideal, and you will make them cripples, hypocrites, mendicants for salvation. The Nazarene said that his kingdom, his purities, were not of this world. Lies, honeyed lies. It was here on earth he founded his slave church. It was men and women, creatures of flesh, he abandoned to the blackmail of hell, of eternal punishment. What were our camps compared with that? Ask a man more than he is. Hold before his tired eyes an image of altruism, of compassion, of self-denial, which only the saint or the madman can touch, and you stretch him on a rack till his soul bursts. What can be crueler than the Jew's addiction to the ideal? First the invisible, but not all-seeing, the unattainable, but all-demanding God of Sinai. Second, the terrible sweetness of Christ. Had the Jew not done enough to sicken man? No, gentlemen, there is a third act to our story. Sacrifice yourself for the good of your fellow man. Relinquish your possessions so that there may be equality for all. Hammer yourself hard as steel. Single emotion, loyalty, mercy, gratitude. Denounce parent or lover so that justice may be achieved on earth, so that history be fulfilled and society be purged of all imperfection. Do you recognize this sermon, gentlemen? The litany of hatred. Rabbi Marx on the Day of Atonement. Was there ever a greater promise? The classless society, to each according to his needs. Brotherhood for all mankind. The earth made of a garden again. A rational Eden, in the name of which compromise, of which promise tyranny, torture, war, extermination were a necessity, a historical necessity. It was no accident that Marx and his minion were Jews, that the congregations of Bolshevism, Trotsky, Rosa Luxemburg, Kamenev, the whole fanatic murderous pack were all of Israel. Look at them, prophets, martyrs, smashers of images, word spinners, drunk with the terror of the absolute. It was only a step, gentlemen, a small, inevitable step from Sinai to Nazareth, from Nazareth to the covenant of Marxism. The Jew had grown impatient. His dreams had gone rancid. Let the kingdom of justice come here now, next Monday morning. Let us have a secular Messiah instead, but with a long beard and his bowels full of vengeance. Three times the Jew was pressed on us, the blackmail of transcendence. Three times he has infected our blood and brains with the bacillus of perfection. Go to your rest. And the voice of the Jew cries out in the night, wake up! God's eye is upon you. Has he not made you in his image? Lose your life so that you may gain it. Sacrifice yourself to the truth, to justice, to the good of mankind. That cry had been in our ears too long, gentlemen, far too long. Men had grown sick of it, sick of to death. When I turned on the Jew, no one came to his rescue. No one. France, England, Russia, even Jew-ridden America did nothing. They were glad that the exterminator had come. Oh, they did not say so openly. I allow you that. But secretly they rejoiced. We had to find to burn out the virus of utopia before the whole of our Western civilization sickened, to return to man as he is, selfish, greedy, short-sighted, but warm and housed, so marvelously housed in his own stench. We were chosen to be the conscience of man, said the Jew. And I answered him, yes, I, gentlemen, who now stand before you, quote, you are not man's conscience, Jew. You are only his bad conscience, and we shall vomit you so we may live and have peace, the final solution. How could there be any other? The question the defendant is raising, rasped Asher, do not interrupt. I will not tolerate interruption. I am an old man. My voice tires. Gentlemen, I appeal to your sense of justice, your notorious sense of justice. Hear me out and consider my third point, which is that you have exaggerated, grossly, hysterically, that you have made of me some kind of mad devil and quintessential of evil, hell embodied, when I was in truth only a man of my time. Oh, inspired, I will grant you, and with a certain, how shall I put it, nose for the supreme political possibility, a master of human moods, perhaps, but a man of my time. Average, if you will, had it been otherwise, had I been the regular demon of your rhetorical fantasies, how then could millions of ordinary men and women have found in me the mirror, the plain mirror of their deeds and appetites? And it was, I will allow you that, an ugly time. But I did not create its ugliness. I was not the worst. Far from it. How many wretched little men of the force did your Belgian friends murder? Outright, or leave to starvation and syphilis when they raped the Congo? Answer me that, gentlemen, or must I remind you? Some 20 million. That picnic was underway when I was newborn. What was Rotterdam or Coventry compared with Dresden or Hiroshima? I do not come out worst in that black game of numbers. Did I invent the camps? Ask the Boers. But let us be serious. Who was it that broke the Reich? To whom did you hand over millions and tens of millions of people, men and women from Prague to the Baltic, set them like a bowl of milk before the insatiable cat? I was a man of a murderous time, but a small man compared with him. You think of me as a satanic liar? Very well. Do not take my word for it. Choose what sainted, unimpeachable witness you will. The holy writer, the great bearded one who came out of Russia and preached to the world. It is some time ago. My memory aches. The man of the archipelago. Yes, that word sticks in my mind. What did he say? That Stalin had slaughtered 30 million people? That he had perfected genocide when I was still a nameless scribbler in Munich? My boys used their fists and their whips. I won't deny it. The times stank of hunger and blood, but when a man spat upon the truth, they would stop their fun. Stalin's torturers worked for the pleasure of the thing, to make men befoul themselves, to obtain confessions which are lies, insanities, obscene jokes. The truth only made them more bestial. It is not I who assert these things. It is your own survivors, your historians, the sage of the gulag. Who then was the greater destroyer? whose bloodlust was the more implacable? Stalin's or mine? Ribbentrop told me of the man's contempt for us, whom he found amateurish, corrupt with mercy. Our terrors were a village carnival compared to his. Our camps covered absurd acres. He had strung wire and death pits around the continent. Who survived among those who had fought him, brought him to power, executed his will? Not one. He smashed their bones to the last splinter. When my fall came, my good companions were alive, fat, scuttled for safety or recompense, cavorted towards you with their contritions and their memoirs. How many Jews did Stalin kill? Your savior, your ally Stalin. Answer me that. Had he not died when he did, there would not have been one of you left alive between Berlin and Vladivostok. Yet Stalin died in bed, and the world stood hushed before the tiger's rest. Whereas you hunt me down like a rabid dog, put me on trial, drag me through the swamps, tie me up at night. Who am I, a very old man of uncertain recollection? Small game, gentlemen, hardly worth your skills. In a world that has tortured political prisoners and poured napalm on naked villagers, that has stripped the earth of plant and animal, that has done these things and continue to do them quite without my help and long after I, the one out of hell, oh ludicrous histrionic phrase, was thought to have been extinct. Asher's breath came loud and empty. Do you trouble yourself, Herr Advocate? I have only one more point to make, the last. That strange book, Der Judenstaat, I read it carefully, straight out of Bismarck. The language, the ideas, the tone of it. A clever book, I agree, shaping Zionism in the image of the new German nation. But Herzl created Israel, or did I? Examine the question fairly. Would Palestine have become Israel? Would the Jews have come to that barren patch of the Levant? Would the United States and the Soviet Union, Stalin's Soviet Union, have given you recognition and guaranteed your survival had it not been for the Holocaust? It was the Holocaust that gave you the courage of injustice, that made you drive the Arab out of his home, out of his field, because he was lice-eaten and without resource, because he was in your divinely ordered way. That made you endure, knowing that those whom you had driven out were rotting in refugee camps not 10 miles away, buried alive in despair and lunatic dreams of vengeance. Perhaps I am the Messiah, the true Messiah, the new Sabbate, whose infamous deeds were allowed by God in order to bring his people home. The Holocaust was the necessary mystery before Israel would come to its strength. It is not I who have said it, but your own visionaries, your unravelers of God's meaning when it is Friday night in Jerusalem. Should you not honor me who made you into men of war, who have made of the long, vicious daydream of Zion a reality? Should you not be a comfort to my old age? Gentlemen of the tribunal, I took my doctrines from you. I fought the blackmail of the ideal with which you have hounded mankind. My crimes were matched and surpassed by those of others. The Reich begot Israel. These are my last words, the last words of a dying man against the last words of those who suffered. And in the midst of incertitude, must matters be left till the great revelation of all secrets. And that's the end of my reading. Left out some stuff, but I don't think I left out what I said, what I read to you, so we'll go from there. We'll talk about it some more tomorrow.
The glow of light boxes. you hear the bell tower ticking. Out on the beltway, they're selling the chicken, where the tempers are short and the hours are long. Darling, won't you meet me? From different directions, and picked them both up before they stepped off the curbs. 'Cause in the hours past midnight, they stopped keeping tabs. The carnival quarters are vacant and sad. But darling, I think there's still a time to be had in the old part of town where your mom met your dad. Darling, won't you meet me in the old part of town? The old part of town. You can still hear the footsteps of the old mystery. The old part of town. You can still feel the heartbeat of the whole history. When the heat on the street is wearing you down. Darling, won't you meet me in the old part of town? Steps of the old mystery, the old part of town.